Welcome, Representative Slug. Would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 2088 to be rolled into the omnibus early childhood finance and policy bill.
Great. You may proceed.
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment.
Is that the A1 amendment?
Yes. I'd like to move the amendment.
Okay, all in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
Mr. Chair, just a question. Do we officially have a quorum?
Yes.
We do. Okay. Okay, thank you.
Amendment carried. Thank you. Senator Pollack.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, this is our official stimulus bill, which is based on the funding from the federal government of about $26 million. We have been working partially with the department on this, as well as taking some pieces to get them into action and for consideration in our final bill. You will see, in summary, the bill increases child care provider rates by 2%, and it includes parent aware star ratings as eligibility criteria for providers with school-ready service agreements, and it allocates funds from the federal stimulus bill. Some of the things, members, towards the back, you will see under Appropriations Section 6 that it would allow stimulus funds to possibly use for school readiness funds, for the basic sliding fee program, for school readiness service agreements, Subdivision 4, the pre-kindergarten exploratory projects, which I think are still in there. And the Subdivision 5, the Quality Rating System Training, Subdivision 6, Quality Rating System Strategic Plan, Subdivision 7, the Quality Rating System, and Subdivision 8, Child Care Assistance Provider Rate. Mr. Chair, members, I do have two testifiers here to talk in particular. As part of the money, there is a quality set-aside, and to talk a little bit more about quality child care and the Parent Aware System.
Great.
Thank you with that.
Welcome to the committee. Could you state your name for the record, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sandy Myers, and I am the Director of Programs for Resources for Child Caring. We are the child care resource and referral agency that provides services in the metro area. In coordination with the Minnesota Child Care Resource and Referral Network and the Child Development Services Unit of the Minnesota Department of Human Services, our organization has assisted with outreach and information on Parents Aware to help inform and recruit participants, coordinate professional development in the areas of curriculum and early childhood assessment, and supported programs in achieving higher ratings through individual consultation and environment. These services have been provided for the most part once the program is already enrolled in Parents Aware, the quality rating system pilot in the areas of St. Paul, North Minneapolis, and the Wayzata School District. I'm here today, though, to share information on how the addition of adding Getting Ready support prior to a program entering Parents Aware would greatly increase the quality of early care and education throughout Minnesota, as well as increasing efficiency in the rating process. I believe you've all been provided copies of the Getting Ready checklist, or will be provided those. This is a tool that early care and education practitioners and programs can follow as they strive to improve their quality areas in areas that research has shown really makes a difference in child outcomes. Exactly how a program might benefit from these Getting Ready supports. Once a program, right now, they apply and they start the Parents Aware process, they put together the binder that consists of all of the materials that are included in that checklist. But with the Getting Ready support, they will get quality improvement needs based on indicators within that checklist, and also receive help in going through that checklist individually. Some of the components that are part of the checklist is child safety. So the first thing they're looking for is the program already licensed? And if they are licensed, are they without maltreatment or negative licensing actions? They're also looking at if the program is already accredited, or if they're interested in pursuing accreditation, because that is another avenue to receiving the 4-star in the quality rating system, and that might be right. Then the checklist goes on to talk about the 4 component areas of the quality rating system, Parents Aware. versus family partnerships, and this is going to include looking for ways that the program is going to be able to document that they get feedback from families, and in fact are actually using that feedback that they get from the families. Are they including a variety of communication means with families? And are they providing individual needs and information about the child in order to best respond to the needs of that child? Are they communicating information on preschool screening and developmental milestones with the parents? The next area in the Parent Aware program is the teaching materials and strategies. So the checklist will help guide the program to see if they are using approved curriculum, and have they also been trained to use it. So they may have gone to a training on it, but have they actually, can they demonstrate that they know how to use it? And if it's not on the approved list, is the curriculum aligned with the early childhood indicators of progress? Do they know about environmental rating scales? And you're going to hear more about that from Terry when she talks later. And this is another measure of environmental quality. The last two components are tracking learning, and this would be about how the program actually tracks the learning of the children in their care. Are they using an approved assessment instrument? And are they using those results to assess and help guide their instruction? And then finally, teacher training and education goes to the actual training the practitioners and the family child care providers and the staff have had themselves. So programs will receive technical assistance in person or over the phone through this getting ready process to help them complete the checklist. And this has particular value in areas for family child care for providers who speak languages other than English. So you can see there's a lot of words on those checklists, but there's a lot of really great things that are happening in all types of child care settings, and that technical assistance will be particularly helpful because there can be staff provided to help them in their home language. So programs will then work with a consultant to help them develop an improvement plan based on the information gathered in the self-assessment. The improvement plan will provide a listing of equipment, materials, training, coaching and mentoring needed to help them get to that 3 or 4 star rating. The examples might include helping them select a curriculum or getting connected to a coach on that curriculum. The consultant can also support them applying for a grant if it is a particular high-cost need that they have through the Child Care Resource and Referral System, if it's identified as part of that improvement plan. The consultant can guide them through the process of registering for training and connect them with assistance if accreditation is the route that they would like to go. By the time they've begun implementing this improvement plan, and at this point they might feel that they are ready to officially join Parents Aware, and then technical assistance can help be provided to them so that they can apply for the program, sign a participation agreement, and connect them with that resource specialist. One of the advantages of getting ready support being added to the Parent Aware process is while it can be very individualized, it can also maximize opportunities for autonomy. Example, there could be groups of providers clustered geographically that could come together with the consultant, talk about the individual components of Parent Aware, make sure they're all in the same field, and they can actually provide a resource to each other on that. Yet, they can get their own individual support for their particular needs. The other thing that they could also do is to learn, maybe go to classroom training on the environmental rating tools, but again, utilize what they learn individually for their own. And of course, any of the early childhood programs can go online. They can get the checklist themselves to start a self-assessment program, but the additional support allotted through increased technical assistance will help those programs that have the most limited resources, language barriers, or just a strong unfamiliarity with the Parents Aware areas. A child care provider, a director, they might know they have a need, but they're not sure where the options are to remediate it or where they can go to get that training or resource. The consultants and coaches utilized at various times during the getting ready process can refer and connect to resources in existence. We're already seeing glimmers of the potential that getting ready supports have in supporting more early care and education programs to increase their quality. We're using those getting ready concepts right now to work with several family child care providers in communities of color that speak languages other than English. And we are scheduled for the May cohort to have 1 Amharic speaker, 1 Oromo speaker, and 5 Hmong providers actually going through the next round of Parents Aware. So I think that speaks volumes to how getting that additional support could be helpful. Some of the other benefits to incorporating getting ready supports include the available resources that are already in the Child Care Resource and Referral and Professional Development System can be aligned towards supporting early care and education programs throughout Minnesota and increasing quality. the early childhood programs that are already doing many of the things proven by research to get kids ready for school will get the additional help in areas not yet meeting the criteria before they formally join a parent aware cohort. Programs that participate in getting ready will require less time and assistance in preparing their documentation and are more likely to receive a 3 or 4 star rating the very first time they join a cohort. And ultimately, families will have more choices of high-quality programs to support them in getting their child school ready. I thank you for the opportunity to share my perspective of the value added from getting ready support as part of the quality rating process, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. So thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer. Questions from members? Representative Bowie?
Mr. Chair and members, I just wanted to mention, I think this is really important as we go out and we talk to people. I think as providers wonder more about the system, that getting them ready is just a key step, and be able to have some money through the recovery money will really help with this process. So appreciate you explaining that. I have another testifier, Mr. Chair, and she will introduce herself. And
welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Carrie Gleason. I currently work at the Assessment and Training Center, which is housed within the Center for Early Education and Development at the University of Minnesota. I am an observer for the quality rating system. I know that some introduction of Parent Aware and the quality rating system has already been explained to you, so what I will explain is when a program decides to become a part of the Parent Aware rating process, they are required to have an observation done in their child care center or home. And I've given a sheet with a little detail about each of the observations and what it is that they are looking for in which age groups, but I will also go through those here. The EFRS is the Early Childhood Environment Rating Scale that's used in center-based preschool classrooms with children ages 30 months through kindergarten entry. The IDERS is the Infant Toddler Environment Rating Scale. We use that in infant or toddler classrooms that are center-based. The FICRS is the Family Child Care Environment Rating Scale. We use those in home-based care settings with groups of children from birth until kindergarten entry. And in center-based preschool classrooms, we use a second assessment tool known as the Classroom Assessment and Scoring System. The environment rating scales, the EFRS, IDERS, and FICRS, are used to measure the quality of the environment, and they take into account the broad subscales of the space and furnishings that are available, personal care routines, language and communication that takes place, activities and materials, as well as how often those are available to the children, interactions, and program structure. The class is used to measure the quality of interactions and instruction within the classroom. And it looks at the broad domains of emotional support, classroom organization, and instructional support. The observers that do these ratings are highly trained individuals. All of us hold an advanced degree in early childhood education or in child psychology or development. Each of us has classroom experience, which we've heard feedback from providers and classroom teachers that that's very important to them, that they have people who understand what it's like to actually work in an early childhood setting. We also bring a unique perspective of understanding developmentally appropriate practice in order to interpret what is seen during the observations, and also that allows us to best help programs to improve their practices and increase the likelihood of optimal outcomes for children. Before actually becoming an observer, each person goes through a rigorous training process where they are required to go to in-class trainings, do 2 to 4 practice observations, and then use what are called reliability observations. A person goes out with a reliable anchor coder. Each of them observes what happens in the same classroom. They independently score what was seen, And in order to be considered reliable, the trainee needs to have 85% of their scores within one of the anchor coders. So if Nora was the anchor coder and I was the trainee, I would need to have at least 85% of my scores within 1 point of the master, the anchor coder. And it actually is extremely difficult and time-consuming and frustrating to do that. But it's really essential that we have both people that are trained in that system so that when one person goes out and does an observation, another person could go out the next day and get approximately the same score, so that we know that the feedback that sites are receiving is accurate and appropriate for their particular site or classroom. So just a description of what actually happens with these observations. The environment rating skills are used in all settings. It just depends on what type of setting. For example, if it's a home daycare, we would use the family child care rating skills. After that, after someone has signed a participation agreement, I'm contacted to hear that they are ready for an observation. We choose a day and a time that will be considered typical for the provider or the center. No special visitors, no field trips. Most of their children are healthy and in attendance. The observation itself takes approximately 3 hours, and during this time, the observers do not interact with the children or the adults. We spend our time observing and documenting evidence of quality in the broad areas I mentioned before. So, for example, space and furnishing, personal care routines, those sorts of things. Once the observation has been completed, the observer then spends 15 to 30 minutes talking to the lead classroom teacher or with the family child care provider, asking questions that they may not have seen during the observation. So, for example, it's not uncommon that we would not see nap time during the time that we're there. It's the observer's responsibility to ensure that they ask questions about that so that they're able to accurately score that item. The observer then scores the entire observation and, based on those scores, writes a very detailed feedback report on areas of strength that were observed as well as areas of need. It is very time consuming to create these reports, but that is usually what we get the most positive feedback from providers about. I had one woman describe to me her feedback report as a love letter to her child care center. And I took that, you know, as a very big compliment, because I want people to be able to use these tools and this feedback in a way that actually is feasible for them to make changes in a positive way and in a lasting way. We have also had some people that had not as much positive feedback for us in terms of the observations. That usually happens if there's been a site that thought that they would rate well and maybe didn't get the score that they would have liked. We are the only part of the system at this point that actually goes into a home or a child care center and spends some time seeing what does this place actually look like, how are children treated here, how is a typical day run. And unfortunately, I can tell you that I have reported child abuse or neglect after some observations. But that really encouraged me that these observations are absolutely essential, because people are putting themselves forth as a high-quality program. And if we're seeing elements there of child abuse or neglect, it's very important that we show them that there are different ways that quality looks in a program, and to help them to understand that there are changes that can be made that really would be best practice for their program. We often hear that observations are expensive, and sometimes that's a concern as to whether or not they are really essential. We strongly support continuing them because, as I said, the feedback that's given is quite expensive, it's detailed information that gives them the exact steps that they can take to improve their program quality. That said, if Parents Aware were to have a statewide model, there are a few ways that we could tweak it so that it would not necessarily be every year that a program would be getting rated. For example, having an official rating every 2 years, or having a consultant work with a provider or a child care program 1 year, and then the next year having a trained observer come and do an observation with feedback would be another choice. In closing, I would say that the most important things about these observations is that the feedback that's given is extraordinarily detailed and specific to the particular program. When programs receive this type of detailed information, they know that the person actually saw exactly what was going on during that time, during that day, and does have a true understanding of what their program is like and can offer them feedback in ways that might be specific to them. Additionally, programs are able to choose which of the suggestions that they would like to incorporate into their own program, so that they don't feel as though they have to change the culture or the nature of their program. For example, there's an area of the environment rating skills that encourages providers to have families actually enter the space where children are spending the majority of their day, actually coming into the child care setting. But there are some programs that transport children by bus, and so their parents are not with them, and they aren't able to receive credit for that. Luckily, programs are still able to say, we feel that transportation is a part of our program that's very important to our families. We have a real reason why we do that, and they are able to choose whether or not that's something that they would like to change. I also think that programs have a better idea of where they would like to spend their program improvement dollars that they're currently receiving. When they have an idea of which areas are of greatest need, it helps them to be able to use those dollars in order to be able to improve their program quality. So I thank you, Mr. Chair, for this opportunity, and I'll invite any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Lisa, and thank you for your work. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question, I guess, for Representative Pollack. And maybe you mentioned this and I missed it, but are we certain the dollars we're spending in this bill, do we know that for a fact yet, how much we have to work with? I notice there's blank appropriations in the bill. Is that, can you just explain?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nornes, thank you for the question. We know that overall the federal stimulus money has included money for child care for each of the states, and in our case it's $26 million. So we do have a definitive amount. Of that $26 million, $3.4 million is for quality. So specifically, as we're looking at, with the blank appropriations at the end, it's to put, because this bill is laid over into our other bill, and because the stimulus money bill will come out along inside of our omnibus bill, it will be part of it. We left the appropriations blank so we can see what are the most strategic use of the funds. For example, you know, getting ready for ratings, or you know, more support for the quality rating system. So that's why we've left them blank for kind of choices. I would say since the bill has been written and with various meetings, we're narrowing this down. I don't think it'll be 8 different programs with a little bit each. It would be maybe 3 programs with some money. So that's the other thing, is that how do you divide up $3.4 million so that's effective and that really makes a difference. And then the bulk, the bigger part, we are working also with the department on how to allocate those funds.
Okay, thanks. Dr. Ephraim, do you have anything to add?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Dr. Karen Ephraim. I'm here as Director of Government Relations for EdWatch. I won't in-depth repeat what I discussed last week as far as our theoretical concerns about the bill, but would just like to concentrate on the quality rating system and recap a few major points. There is no mention, no actual word of voluntary in any of these bills that discuss quality rating system. And even if there were, as Representative Slawik mentioned in a previous hearing, she sees it as programs potentially being forced in order to compete for referrals and funding to get these ratings and be involved in this system.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Slawik.
I don't know if I would say being forced, but it will be a competitive system, and it's just like if there's a Burger King next to McDonald's, if places are getting ratings, there will be some market forces.
Right.
I think it's market forces that will work to create potentially people to participate in a quality service system.
Dr. Efron.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There is no data yet to justify the cost and potential intrusiveness of this program. There is an enormous burden on child care providers. You heard eloquent testimony a few weeks ago from Joy Massard, a private child care provider from Scott County, about her concerns related to cost, paperwork, intrusiveness, taking away time from her kids. And there's the accreditation issue. The document that you received from one of the other testifiers talks about accreditation by the National Association for the Education of Young Children. And the state already is paying child care providers a differential if they are accredited by this organization, which EdWatch has enormous concerns about, given the type of curriculum and standards that they promote that have nothing to do with closing the achievement gap and are highly controversial issues such as gender identity and anatomy. They have training for children in activism. They have curriculum on healthy sexual development. And these are all issues that the state should not be promoting through accreditation by organizations. That is an issue for parents. So that is a major concern. And then finally, parents are not asking for this kind of rating system, particularly the academic issues. Yes, they care about safety. They care about cleanliness. They care about cost and hours and convenience. They care about communication, but they are not asking, and if you read the surveys on the Department of Human Services website, they are not asking for the state to be educating and assessing their children, especially in these controversial areas that I've mentioned. So we do not support the parent aware system as it is currently manifested, and there's really no idea of what's going to actually end up. But we don't think that the state should be imposing this kind of system on especially private child care providers.
Thank you, Dr. Efron. Any questions from members? Representative Slawik, Representative Downey.
If I could, thank you. I just wanted to make sure I'm clear on kind of the conversion from the school readiness service agreements to the QRS. And I apologize, I showed up a little late. Some testifiers might have covered this, but does everybody with an SRS, a have to still convert over to QRS? And I'm actually kind of curious about the numbers of organizations that we're dealing with here and how reasonable it is to expect that they would all be able to kind of switch over to the QRS to be available for the funding. Is that question making sense to you?
I'm not sure exactly. And so converting, so if they're involved in the School Readiness Connections Program?
Well, if they have an SRSA, excuse me, Mr. Chair, if they have an agreement today, I guess my question is, do they have to convert over to the QRS rating system? Am I making sense there?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd like the department to jump in here. And Mr. Chair, I would like to just comment a little bit after
Absolutely.
That.
Absolutely. And there are 14 providers, Representative Downey.
Oh, that's the number. Oh, okay. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record, please.
My name is Sharika Tilnick, and I work with the Department of Human Services at the Child Care Assistance Program, and you are correct. I'm looking at your name tag as Slawick, and that's not going to work. you are correct. There are 14 providers, and the providers, the school readiness service agreements were put into place before Parent Aware was put into place, but we did everything we could to align the standards that we used to choose providers with ones we expected to be in Parent Aware. So we anticipate that it should not be a problem for almost all, if not all, of the providers to comply with.
Thank you. My question was actually really about the numbers and whether we could handle that kind of conversion here in this first year. Thank you.
Representative Flowers, do you have some comments?
Mr. Chair, I just, you know, when we, there are always two sides to every bill and every part of it, and I just, Sandy and I happen to sit on the MNACI board together. That is the group that does the accreditation for programs, and I think just a reminder that MNACI, the Minnesota National Association for the Education of Young Children, which does accrediting, it is as a voluntary process. The centers are seeking that, as well as voluntary for parents to participate in as well. You know, if there's part of that, you can comment on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the programs that child care resource and referral agencies do is we do help parents seek and select child care. And while they might not use the same words that the Parents Aware tool maybe is getting at, we do hear over and over, they want to find what are the programs that my child is going to learn? What are the programs that will help me make sure my child is successful when they start school? And the tool accreditation being one of the tools that exists, and it being one of the options to getting that level 4 rating or the 4-star rating with Parent Aware. The Parent Aware as a tool also is there to inform parents what goes into a high quality program. And again, they can choose or not choose depending on their own value system for their family. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyer.
In closing, members, I hope you'll look over the bill carefully, talk to me, or we can have more of a further conversation about what you think should be in the stimulus bill. These are ideas for recovery. We know that jobs are priority. We want to create jobs out of this. We want to do use that quality set aside to move the quality rating system forward, as well as use some of the money for basic funding fee. So with that, Mr. Chair, appreciate your consideration.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? That I move that House File 2088 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Education Finance and Policy Bill.
Switching of the chairs here. Thank you, Representative Rosenbaum. Excellent job. And not too much more of that. Committee's almost over, so probably be one relief. With that, we are going to start on the next bill, which is Representative Wise Bill House File. Let's see. 2202. Would you like to move your bill, Representative Bly?
Yes, I would like to move my bill, and I understand this would be move for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, is that correct?
Yes.
That's what I would move to. I don't have any amendments. I just would like to say that, you know, before coming to the legislature, I had a 30-year career as a teacher, and most of those years I worked with at-risk students, and I learned in my experience that oftentimes after school or times when you could engage a student differently or even meet with their parents was really an important time, and you could sometimes turn a student around and improve their ability to do well in school. And over the years, there have been programs that have been developed to reach students who needed some extra attention or needed to have their attitudes change a little bit about what school's about and how it can be a positive place instead of something to be feared or not so sure about. And I had with me a couple of testifiers who will speak to that. And in thinking about these programs, I wanted to see if there was a way to capture some of the recovery money. And although specifically it doesn't talk about after-school programs are funded through K-12 programs. So that's my hope, is that we can direct some of the money in that direction. And I have with me Marnie Thompson, who is assistant principal at the high school, and actually I've worked closely with Marnie on some of the students that we've struggled to find a way to help them be more successful, and she's done some very good work in my district. And also, thank you, Laura LaCroix-DeLune, who also has some information for us about these programs. So maybe, Marnie, you'd like to start?
Okay. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to say your name for the record, and then...
Marnie Thompson, assistant principal at Northville High School, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm back. I was here a few weeks ago and had quite a large gallery of students with us. I don't have them today. They're actually on a out-of-school time programming field trip today. And if you'll recall, we also had Champagne and Ruth with us that day to testify about the importance of after-school programming. I wanted to come back today to just reiterate a couple of numbers and give you some new data that's fresh off the presses after the last 6 months of programming. If you'll recall, I stated last time that 1,170 students, which is approximately one-third of our student body, access programs that were supported by the after-school and out-of-school time programming grants. The purpose of those programs is really to close the achievement gap and look at increasing the feelings of connections that kids have to both their school and their community. During the first 6 months of this year, we've already had 992 Northfield youth participating in these programs. About one-third of them have been participating at least 30 or more times. From our mid-year evaluations, we took some, asked the kids some questions, and of those 990-some children, 96% of the kids in the program believe that they will stay in school and go on to attend college. Please remember that these are children that refer to the program for academic support, and 96% of them believe they can do this. 80% believe that the primetime program helps them do better in school. 95% say that report that the program staff believe in them and believe they can learn. About 80% of the students indicated an improved knowledge of community resources, and 80% reported that they had discussed with program partners what they were going to do for academic classes that they needed to pursue their college and post-secondary plans. I think most enlightening for me is that 93% of the youth reported that primetime staff care about them, and that 90% of the students report that people in the community like them. This is an important statistic, since research shows that the presence of caring adults is a very strong protective factor. In our 2007 Minnesota student survey data, less than 50% of the students responded that people in their community care about them. That includes teachers, police, religious leaders, and community members. And we're already seeing, just after 1 year of after-school programming, incredible trends in how kids feel about people caring about them. In addition, we're seeing significant academic improvement. Last year, the students in prime time, 83% of them showed improved academic scores on nationally normed Northwest Evaluation Association measures. And the average prime time student improved over 3 percentile points in math and language usage,
on these same national standardized tests. This growth that these students have was roughly twice that of their peers that were not in the program. Our attendance rates in school are improving because of our after-school program, and the GPAs of all of the students participating in our evening homework help session have increased. Our results in just 1 year have far exceeded our expectations. Our after-school programs are really proving to be great equalizers. Kids with few opportunities have access to safe, stable academic support. I was hoping to bring with me a young man today that I call my million-dollar man. But he's on a bus right now with 110 children in out-of-school time programming during our spring break. These are children that don't have access to spring break trips or anything else, but we've been using some of our funding to provide three educational opportunities for them this week while other families are out and about doing other things. But back to Josh. When he was in middle school, he was failing, truanting, and on a trajectory to drop out. When we got him hooked up with after-school programming to help with his academics and feelings about school. Now, as a sophomore, he served in several leadership capacities in Northfield and at the state level. He volunteers in the very same programs that supported him the last 2 years, and he is on the B honor roll. Had he continued on the dropout trajectory, he would have cost society an average of $800,000 over the course of his lifetime due to decreased income and reliance on social services. Supporting after-school programs like this makes good economic sense to me, and I thank you again for trying to include this very important issue in this bill.
We are glad you're here. We're missing having the students, though.
Sorry, they're on the bus.
Oh, they were great, and was great having them. And I think we need a reality check with all that here at the legislature too. So, but we're glad you came back.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Laura LaCroix-DeLuna. I'm the Executive Director of Youth Community Connections for the statewide after-school and out-of-school time alliance. So we work with public agencies, private funders, and then the direct service providers to do field building. I want to hit on a couple highlights that haven't already been touched on today. So I'm going to kind of skip around here on my testimony just to move through this. But I think it's very important that the committee recognizes that young people have approximately 2,000 hours of unstructured time each year. That's about the equivalent of a full-time job. And that's nearly double the amount of time that they spend in the classroom each year. So what kids do when they're not in school is equally important to their goals and their success in life as what they gain from being in the classroom. And there's a growing literature to support this. We have literature that clearly articulates that kids who engage in high quality after school opportunities such as those that learning students participate in see increases in test scores, see increases in grades, ability to stay on task and attentive in the classroom, are more likely to graduate from high school, less likely to drop out and move on to college. Additionally, there are other positive benefits to the community that you've heard stated before, and that is decreases in crime rates. That's a direct link. The Sheriff's Association and police departments across the state are actively trying to find positive things for kids to be involved in. We know if the funds for these after-school programs go away, we will see spikes of crime after school, and we can anticipate that. We also know that when kids are engaged in high-quality after-school opportunities, they're less likely to engage in sexual activity, and they're less likely to engage in alcohol and drug and tobacco use. Similarly, I think it's important to identify our Education Secretary Arne Duncan today was talking with mayors across the country about how do we support learning before kids get into the school day through early childhood education by preventing them from dropping out and then engaging them in high quality and summer learning opportunities. It's not unique to the students in Northfield that when they engage in these after school and summer programs that they can chip away at the achievement gap. We know what it takes to get there, and we're asking for your support in doing that. I just wanted to highlight a couple things, two other things if I can. I wanted to touch on some of the current grantees We've had the opportunity to hear from Northfield. But approximately 9,000 students across the state are being served with the current after-school funds. There are 21 grantees. When the RFP went out, only 10% of the requests were funded. So there were nearly $60 million in requests for the $5 million that were let back in 2007. Of the 9,000 participants, or approximately 9,000 participants, over half of them are kids of color, and half of them are female. And it is a requirement of all grantees that they leverage other community resources. So when you average out what other community resources are being leveraged, it averages to be about $200 per student, per participant that is leveraged in other community resources. That would be another potential loss. And while Youth Community Connections and all of its partners are incredibly empathetic to the challenges that you all have in creating a budget during these tight recessions, during these tight economic times, we ask you to consider the continuity of care for young people. We had an after-school program in 1996 that ran through 2003. The funding went away. We saw peaks of crime. We saw increases in our pregnancy rates. You can look at the trends for our state. We saw an increase in our achievement gap. When we have these programs in place, we can start to make progress in positive ways. So we're asking you to think creatively with us about how do we create flexible funding with the existing funding sources that are present. And in the new report that was released by the Department of Education, they put out a report on the funding streams that are dedicated towards after school and out of school time. There are seven dedicated funding sources, four of which are state funds. They go to the 4-H program, they go to crime prevention programs, and then through the K-12 committee, the targeted services dollars and learning year acceleration dollars. So for those of you who sit on that committee, you'd be familiar. But we're asking for flexibility and creativity when we come together. With that, I will answer questions.
Questions, members? What will happen to the programs that, when their funding runs out? Are they going to completely fold, or is part of it picked up by the school district, or how does that work?
Part of it for us is already picked up by the school district, but what we will have to do is skinny them down, to bare bones and offer much less programming. We certainly hope that we wouldn't have to decrease the number of students, but all of our budget really goes to staff and transportation, and we're not going to compromise the safety of the program by having too many children with not enough staff. So, we might have to drop off some grade levels. We just haven't really wanted to address that yet, but certainly it will be dramatically decreased, the level of programming that we're able to offer.
Does funding go through the school year then?
Yep, we run summer programs as well. We have a 7-week, 8-hour-a-day program that children can access during the summer for both academic support and enrichment, and that is free to those children and their families during the summer months.
Representative Downey, do you have a question?
Yeah, actually, if I could, maybe a couple. Thank you, Madam Chair. Are these all across all age groups, or do these 21 grants tend to kind of land in a certain age strata?
I think that's for you, Ms. LaCroix.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, 41% serve grades K through 5, 26% serve grades 6 through 8, 23% serve grades 9 through 12, and for those of you who are adding, 10% are unknown.
I've read a lot about the achievement gap being worsened over summer months, and I'm curious whether any of those 21 grants actually kind of carried through the summer, or whether there maybe be an interest in this new grant money being directed to some programs that maybe experimented with that.
Yes, Madam Chair, ours has run through the last two summers, and we will have complete programming again this summer. We see that as a very, very valuable piece because we do see attrition in score rates or scores over the summertime months, and we've been able to, because we just did this last summer, and now this summer we don't have good longitudinal data, but what we're seeing is that it's trending positively, that the kids come back in a better place than when they left the school year in June.
Representative Downing.
Just one final one. So I know we're grabbing stimulus funds that are presumably one time. Are there any strings attached to that money, either in terms of how we can or can't use it in the here and now, and then does it create any kind of ongoing obligation that we'd have to fund downstream that we aren't maybe prepared for?
President Blyer?
Well, I don't know the absolute answer to that. My sense is that because these are grants anyway, there isn't necessarily any guarantee of ongoing money. And, you know, we're putting this out there in a sense to find out is there money available that we can apply for these grants. Staff might have some other comments about it, too.
Ms. Bradkey, would you like to comment on that?
No.
No. I saw a whole memo on this.
The state fiscal stabilization fund is the pot of money we're looking at, and that is all dedicated towards state school funding and higher education funding. And the allocation that was in the budget note we received on Friday.
You can talk into the mic.
You
can tell I'm not used to doing this. Indicated that there was not going to be money allocated for this purpose, but we're still in a review period when we're told that we can have discussions with the agency to see how they might work within that funding.
Sure. Mr. Eisenman, I thought you used to be on the school board.
Many, many, many years ago.
You've been before a mic before, I think.
I have.
Thank you. If that's what we're trying to figure out, the stimulus funds and the recovery funds, I mean, there's a lot. The good news is there's a significant amount for K-12 and in child care of the $26 million, but exactly how they can be used is very much, you know, still being defined. I'm hoping the stabilization funds, which are programs that need to be continued, will kick in here. Representative Blyer?
Well, I see these programs as really valuable. And about a year ago, I attended a conference of legislators on higher education, and they were talking about the demographic changes that we're going to be going through and how when baby boomers move into the retirement age, we're going to need more workers to support them. And what they said was that what we have to do is look at those students who are not achieving so well now and do whatever we can to make sure that they go on and get post-secondary education of some kind to step into those roles that will support the rest of us. And I know from my own experience that these kinds of programs can really help turn students around. And I think it does fit into that role of making sure that we are able to have those folks to keep our society going. So.
Representative Norris?
Madam Chair, I just had a question. Since we're talking after-school programs, one of the programs I recall from some time ago was the Garter Youth Program. Is that still, did that go away completely? Are you familiar with that?
Representative Norris, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it took place, the National Guard Armories were kind of the host site, and it was an excellent program because it was essentially almost a free deal because supervision was provided by the Guard members and the facility was provided by the Guard members. Of course, not every community would probably had a facility, but where there were facilities, and I visited Moorhead where they had a program and others, and it seemed like, not that these aren't good programs, but in addition to what we're talking about today, if that had gone away, I'd sure like to at some point go back and revisit that because, again, they had excellent role models and it was what I saw, just one of those programs that you couldn't improve on, but I think it may have just disappeared.
I said, Representative Nornis, I think we came in about the same time, and we're both on early childhood, I think. Way back then, I think, with Tony Kinkle was the chair, and as I recall, we did have testimony, and we did fund that. We used to have a line of funding for this, whereas now we're doing it as these one-time grants. It used to be more of a regular decision on what programs we're going to get the funding. Also, when you think about when we came in, the relation to that to now and how the National Guard has changed and what's happened in the economy and the country
It just occurred to me that was an excellent program, and if there's any way that in the future, excuse me, at least in some communities, get a start again, it would be worth looking into.
Any other questions, members? We have some testimony by Dr. Efren who's going to testify, and then after that, Representative Bly will have some closing comments. Welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record and proceed to the
question. Good afternoon again. My name is Karen Efren. I'm here on behalf of EdWatch. These programs are nice, but they may be an unaffordable luxury, and we have to keep that in mind. The data that was discussed in the testimony today was a lot about feelings, and feelings are nice, and good feelings are nice, but that doesn't really do anything to concretely close the achievement gap. And the data, the concrete number data that I heard was a 3% improvement on the NWEA. That's nice too, but what is the practical value of that for closing the achievement gap? And is there any concrete data on actual improvements in graduation rates? Are there any actual data on college completion rates for children that have participated in these programs? And I'm also hearing lots of ideas about what kids do in their out-of-school time, you know, after school and the summer. And while it is nice to help students that are having problems, it is not the government's role, nor does the government have the authority to involve itself and decide, you know, the mandatory community service that was just passed by the U.S. House aside. They do not have the authority to be doing that. So we have enough trouble in the state funding the actual obligation of education K through 12 during the school day. And as nice as these programs may be and as nice as they sound, that is the first priority. And in tight budgetary times, individuals, families, states, and nations have to concentrate on priorities first. So that's all I would say. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think Representative Rosenthal.
Dr. Efren, I think these programs are more than nice. As we heard from some of the other testifiers, they're critical. They save us money going down the line, I think $800,000 during a lifetime. That's not a trivial amount of money. And these kids need to boost up so they can become productive. So just saying it's nice, I think, is ignoring the problem.
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenthal, I haven't heard $800,000 per individual. If there was actual concrete data that showed that, I would certainly be more interested in supporting. But the data that I heard last hearing and this hearing talks about increased feelings, and it talks about 3% on a test. And I'm just asking you to really consider what the real data is, and not projected things, and to have it be concrete as you're making your decisions. That's all.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of my communities borders on a community with a very high crime rate here in the metro area, and last year they had out of after school programs, and they were crying for grants because in the long run, unless they have activities for those students during the after school hours, they do get involved with gangs, they get in trouble, And the police force were the first people on the line to advocate for those programs because they do save money in the long run in terms of the crime rate, in terms of getting them involved. I had a young man in today who got involved with some of those programs, and he's getting some of the leadership skills that he needs in order to be able to do things that he said he thought he never would be able to do. And he was up helping to with the community ed director, actually, finding out about the legislature and lobbying, and he was there with a senior citizen. And very, very excited about the opportunities that he never would have had access to. So sometimes it's not just even the classroom, it's the opportunities to take part in some of these other activities that provide leadership and get them involved with other kinds of activities that are beneficial, because it's not all work, but you learn through experiences, and these are experiences that are valuable. I think if you talk to our safety, our police, or the police and involved in public safety, you will find that they're our strongest advocates, and the mayors of the city, by the way, the biggest advocate was the mayor of the two cities, who said, we need these kinds of programs for our students, particularly these were high school, junior high school students that they were looking at. There may be parts of the state where this isn't so necessary, but it certainly is necessary for much of the metropolitan area. And we need more resources and more funds. We really just don't have what we need to be able to provide for these students during the summer and after school. Madam Chair.
Ms. Efram.
Representative Peterson, the research, if you read the research, the thing that is the single biggest factor for not just improving the achievement gap, but erasing it, for preventing crime, preventing teen sexual activity and the pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases that accompany that, for mental health problems, is impact to parent families. That works. That's not 3%. That is erasing the achievement gap. And all I'm saying is that we need to prioritize our funding and our policy to do what works best.
We have Representative Peterson and Representative Downey and then Representative Coolidge Jackson.
Thank you. And I don't want to get into a debate here, but and also, I think intact two parent families are wonderful, and I'm going to agree with you on that. I think that would be wonderful if we had that. But it also depends on the kind of relationship that exists in those two parent families. If it's laden with negative emotional impact for the child, then maybe it isn't the best situation. And the we're dealing with reality here, and the reality is that not all of those students do have two parents, and they live with a single parent, and we do have to deal with the reality. I'm not sure we can legislate all of the social needs and this utopia that would be maybe wonderful for everyone, but it's not going to happen right now. So we need to take care of our students the best we can. Madam Chair.
Ms. Efram.
I still don't think that you are actually saying that a government program is going to do better than families would do, because they won't. And again, it is a matter of priority. And if we continually raise taxes and increase government spending for programs that are less effective or not effective or undermine families, then yes, they're going to have problems. But if we leave families alone and actually allow them to keep income that they earn, then
families have a better chance of being able to provide these things that you are wanting to use government programs for.
President Downing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe a little different tack here. I'm curious about the 21 grant programs, and maybe Representative Bly or somebody else who's in the department could answer. How many of those were kind of academically focused as compared to simply providing a safe, warm place for the kids in a more social setting? Is there any information on that in terms of the structure of the programs?
If we're Corey DeLune, or is there someone, I don't know if someone from the department is here that works with the grant program?
From my experience, well, excuse me, here we are up here, there is an academic component of them. But it's really, you know, I think critical that these programs help students feel good about being in school. And although we feelings are discredited here, they are important. We are human beings that have both feeling and thinking minds, and I think that the attitude that students have towards school is very important. I have seen it in my 20 years working with at-risk students that if you can develop a relationship and show them that adults do care about them, it can make a tremendous difference in their ability to succeed and graduate. I could tell you story after story, and many of them came from families that couldn't provide that. And the school was able.
LaCroix DeLune, I see the department's up in the gallery, and you're here, and do you have the answer for Representative Downey or close to
you? Giving them the. Are you sure you want me to answer this book? sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Downey. If I can just quickly give you the actual data.
I think the department selected the applicants.
In the year one report of the current grantees, it appears that 86% of the 64 86% are doing focusing on academic achievement as a priority activity or goal area of the grantees. And the department can correct me if I'm interpreting the report improperly.
I've head shaking that you're right. I know we have a couple other questions. That Representative Downey, anything else? Okay, we have Representative Coolidge-Jackson.
Well, I just want to make the point that I believe it is government's role to offer these things. And I know that we don't coerce parents. It's always voluntary. But I have seen data that I wish I had in front of me that clearly shows, especially with regard to middle school and high schoolers, that those kids who are involved in after-school activities, including extracurricular activities, have much lower incidences of everything from juvenile delinquency to pregnancy to alcohol use, and the list goes on and on. They tend to do better in school academically also. And as taxpayers, I can speak for myself as a taxpayer, I want to invest my money here because I know that I will pay for special ed. I know that I will pay for the juvenile justice system. I know that I will pay when someone is unsuccessful and drops out and is on public assistance, and it goes on generation after generation. And I also believe that that's a whole lot more money. And so it's economically sound, and I think it's a good moral choice for those families who cannot provide it themselves. I had an intact two-parent family that struggled financially, and but for the extra things provided, I wouldn't be here right now.
I think we have one other, Representative Lane.
Again, a comment. As Representative Bly said, the relationship adult to child is the key thing at the foundation of any education at any point in our lives, always. And I think that that's what sometimes called on when we speak of the nuclear family. We're really talking about relationship. We're talking about relationship from a loving adult to a child. But in fact, I'm concerned. Well, okay, we'll say research shows that relationship is the key factor, and that in fact, research also shows that it isn't this modern anomaly called a nuclear family of two parents that actually does the trick. It is an extended family. It's the extended family that we've lost, and that is why we are saying these days it takes a village to raise a child, because it takes more. I've always said, raising my five children in a two-parent family, that it takes more than us to do this. You have to, I will find whoever you connect to as an adult important in your life. I will make sure that those relationships are appropriate and filled out, because we can't do this ourselves. No individual or even twosome can do it. It takes an extended family, and these days that is such things as a community coming together. And what we're doing is giving grants to a community to do what they see fit to do in their work as a village raising a child.
Thank you. I'll lend my support, and then I think I'll let you close, Representative Bly. Members, when I meet with Ms. LaCroix of DeLune, and I carry the bill version for the committee, I actually have a degree in recreation administration, which I don't always talk about, but I do, because of after-school programs and of serving kids. So when I went to college, I studied how to work for the Red Cross, the YMCAs, the Boys Clubs, Girls Clubs, and how to help those, because that to me is really important when you're making the difference in the life of a kid. So I think the bill that you bring before us is very important. That I think the members have made points. There's always points on all sides here at the legislature, but I think it helps us to think about what we're doing here. I think, members, we are all well aware of the budget situation and that it is a very difficult year. We know that there are people in our state that have lost their jobs and that are struggling. And so we down here take that very seriously, and I know we take this seriously with this bill. And this is a bill that's a shot with the stimulus funds that are brought to our states through Congress to help us during these difficult times. And so to me it seems certainly a good fit for the stabilization funds, and seems like it could help kids in our communities, and thank you for bringing the bill forward. Representative Bly, any closing comments?
Well, you've said it much better than I probably could. And I want to thank you for initially carrying the bill. I was very pleased to see that you were doing that, and it's because I know what these programs can do for kids, and I've seen it happen in my own district, students I've worked with, and I'm very happy to bring it forward if it can result in continuing some of the funding and the good work that folks are doing out there. So thank you so very much for hearing the bill, and I renew my motion to have the bill considered for inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you. Representative Bly moves House File 2202 be laid over for possible inclusion in the Early Childhood Finance and Policy Omnibus Bill. That, member, anything else? Okay. And we are adjourned.